Good vach, thank you everyone for coming. As we try to gain a little chizik before we begin slichos, kicking off the Yom Menorah, b'shus Rabbi Kamenetsky, b'shus the entire DRS Mishpacha. You know, one thing I've always found a little bit strange, and in a sense also, dare I say, funny, is whenever you hear an advertisement for a medicine, right, without fail, part of that advertisement says, ask your doctor to prescribe you. It's a funny thing to say, right? You're going to the doctor, right? The doctor obviously is paid the big bucks because he knows what's best for you. Yet the advertisement says, ask your doctor to prescribe you, as if you know what the doctor should give to you. The Dibno Magid gives the following mashal. The Dibno Magid says, imagine you have a person, he comes to the doctor, he says, doctor, I feel very weak. I feel very thirsty all the time. I feel very stressed out. Prescribe me a high cholesterol diet. Prescribe me 6 beers a day. Prescribe me 2 packs of cigarettes. Obviously, the guy's crazy. Those aren't his symptoms. And the Dibno Magid says, because sometimes that's the sign of a person who's sick, when he is asking for the things that would hurt him. And I think the same can be said sometimes about tefillah. Tefillah is a tricky thing, for many reasons. But I think one of the reasons that tefillah can be so tricky is because sometimes we think we know what's best for us. We want the doctor to prescribe for us X, Y, or Z, but the truth is, it might not really be what's best for us. We say in Shmoneh Esrei, Melech Ozer Moshio Magin, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the King who is Ozer, he helps us. We know that we can't do anything without the help of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He is Moshiach. Sometimes where it's beyond our control, we've done everything we could. Hashem helps us, he saves us anyway. And he is Magin. So generally, the way we understand Magin, protecting, is that sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu saves us in a way that we don't even know that we were in danger from something external in the first place. That before the threat even got to us, Hashem sort of thwarted that danger. But the Vilna Gaon like to explain that Magin means something else. That Magin actually means that Hashem sometimes protects us from ourselves. That sometimes when we're asking for something that's really not for the best, not best for us, Hashem protects us from that as well. My Rebbe, Rabbi Willig, once said he was talking on Inyanei Tefillah. And he mentioned the well-known sefer of praying with fire. And he said, very kedarko, he said, praying with fire, but it's also playing with fire. You have to understand that tefillah is very much, it's a very big koach, it's a very, very powerful thing. You have to be careful. But sometimes we're pretty sure in what we're davening for. We're pretty confident that what we're asking Kadosh Baruch Hu for is the right thing. This past summer, in the span of 18 days, 18 short, but very long and trying days, Klal Yisrael was tested in a way that we probably haven't been tested for in many, many years. Our emunah was challenged, our spirits were broken, but perhaps most of all, the efficacy, the impact, the effect of our tefillos was called into question. What happens to our tefillos? 18 days, it's 432 hours. We daven for the safe return of our boys. And we all know, we all felt it. This was not just stam, a regular tefillah. We all felt the power in that tefillah, the sincerity, the heartfelt emotion, the unity in that tefillah. And as a result of that, we were so sure that the only possible outcome could be a positive one. We felt so good about it. We felt so optimistic. We felt so confident. But alas, on June 30th, we discovered the horrible news, what happened to the 3 boys. And with that news came a very daunting and deflating reality. The reality that out of 432 hours of tefillah, it may have just been 1 hour that we were actually davening for something. Everything else was seemingly lemafreya, it was for naught. Because Kadosh Baruch Hu already had decided what would occur. What happens to tefillos such as those? That could be something that can really eat at a person, that can challenge a person. And it must be then that our emunah remains strong. And even when, a few weeks later, in a well-known interview with Sean Hannity, Mrs. Frankel basically said that although this was, for me, obviously a personal tragedy, it may have saved dozens of lives, hearing those words, for me personally at least, certainly gave me chizuk, that a mother just lost a child, basically saying to the extent of, it's terrible what happened, but perhaps it was those tefillos for the past 18 days that led to us discovering these tunnels. Certainly it'd be a feel-good story. We like to think that we know where our tefillos are going to at all times, but we have to understand we just don't know. It's playing with fire to try to guess what Hashem is doing. Sometimes we see the effect of our tefillos, but sometimes we don't. But what I would like to focus on tonight is not so much what we don't know about tefillah, and not the times that we don't see our tefillos answered. But I would like to focus on the koach of tefillah, what we do know about it. Not so much that we're going to be privy to know, the reality is that Hashem made it that way purposely. He's the doctor, He knows what's best for us. But there is something that we can know about tefillah, and I think hopefully we could take that message with us going into the Yom HaNorayim. So I figured what better place to start to examine the koach of a tefillah than in what my opinion is probably the greatest tefillah of all history. I like to call it the trifecta. Maybe for some sports enthusiasts in the room, the triple crown. I speak of the tefillah of the holiest person on the holiest day in the holiest place. The Kohen Gadol in the Kodesh Kedoshim on Yom Kippur, this ultimate bang of Kedusha converging into one awesome moment. What does the Kohen Gadol say there? What's that tefillah? What does it look like? You can imagine the intensity of that moment. The Kedusha was so great, Chazal tell us that it had to be a tefillah katsara, it had to be a short tefillah. Because, you see, the Kedusha was so intense that one brief slip of concentration on the part of the Kohen Gadol and he could die. And so therefore, it was instituted, he had to have a tefillah katsara, otherwise Bnei Yisrael would be afraid, he hasn't come out yet, maybe something happened to him. So he has such a small window, such a small, short amount of time to daven on his very large and broad shoulders, the weight not just of him and his family, but of all of Klal Yisrael and the kapara of all of Klal Yisrael. What is he going to say in those moments? I think looking at that will help us understand what a tefillah is. And he says a lot of things, different variations brought down in different places in the Mishnah and Yerushalmi. But he says a lot of things that you would expect him to say. He davens, of course, that the tefillos of Klal Yisrael should be answered. He davens for a year of parnasa, for a year of rain. He davens that there should be din in Beis Din and in court, that there should be MS, there should be justice. He davens that there should be no miscarriages, that families should be healthy. Yerushalmi tells us that he davens that we should not be led into gullus this year. And if there is a gullus, chas v'shalom, it should be to a place where there's Torah. And if there is no parnasa, we should unfortunately be aniyim as a result of giving tzedakah and supporting Torah learning. All very important tefillos. And now just imagine, his time is winding down, he has a few seconds left in this awesome, juiced up moment of spirituality, of tefillah, of kedusha. What's the last words he's going to shtup in there before it's over? And almost all versions of his tefillah end with the same, seemingly strange conclusion. He says, he davens to Hashem that he should not answer, Kadosh Baruch Hu should not answer the tefillos of the Ovrei Drachim. The people who lived outside of Yerushalayim, who would have to travel back and forth, whether it was to be Olel Regel, whether it was to go do their business in the marketplace in Yerushalayim, don't listen to them. Okay, very nice. You want to daven for that? The Ovrei Drachim, what are they daven for? They daven that there shouldn't be rain, right? They didn't want to get rained upon. So that's their business. But that's what the Kohen is going to focus his energies on, the last moments that he has in this tefillah katsara, this small window that he has. It seems very strange. Aside from the obvious, aside from the fact that who cares about these guys who have their own agenda? I mean, in a few days from now, it's going to be Sukkot, and Klal Yisrael as a whole has got to start saying Mashiv Ruach. They're going to start davening for rain. The Kohen, just in his own tefillah, davened that it should be a year of rain. So he has to end his tefillah worrying about some guys that are going to be davening for something that's not good for the rest of Klal Yisrael. Hashem's going to care about that? Mind you, Chazal tell us that these Ovrei Drachim weren't Rishayim. They weren't doing something bad. They were just thinking of themselves. I think the answer is very simple. The answer is yes. Yes, the Kohen had to put in this tefillah. And I believe it is the conclusion of his tefillah to teach us a very important message. Imagine for these Ovrei Drachim, what are they davening for? Doesn't seem so important to us, but back then, you know, being rained on wasn't really just a little thing. It was a big deal. They didn't have umbrellas. They didn't have a house to retreat to or a nearby store or a Dunkin' Donuts to just go into until the rain calmed down. They didn't have a car to get it jump into. If it rained on them while they were traveling, they would be stuck there in the rain in the middle of a desert with nowhere to go. Their produce would get ruined. Whatever they're going to sell in Yerushalayim would get destroyed. Even worse, they can get sick, deathly ill even. And this was a serious thing for them. I think what Chazal is trying to teach us is, even somewhere, some place where the tefillah by the Ovrei Drachim is not really for the benefit of Klal Yisrael, but Hashem looks at that tefillah as an individual. And those individuals, they're davening with kavana. There's something that they feel they need, they want to be protected, they want to be kept safe, they don't want to be rained on. And they daven. And therefore, the Kohen is sort of sending us this message that when there's kavana, that's a force to be reckoned with. But what is kavana? Usually we translate it as concentration. To focus. To focus on our davening, to concentrate on our davening. But I don't know. A lot of times, I could speak just for myself, I close my eyes, I look at the words, I try not to let my mind wander. Do I feel like I have a lot of kavana? I try, but certainly not always successful. So what is kavana that makes it so powerful? If the Kohen himself has to worry about this so much. So the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells the following story. The following story goes like this. Reuven and Shimon, all the DRS tell me that Reuven and Shimon have already been up to no good this year with Edom Zomim. Now they've committed murder. They're not just accusing someone of murder, they've committed murder. And they're brought to court, they're tried for their capital crime. They were partners in crime together, so they're punished together. Both of them will be sentenced to death. What do you do? So Reuven and Shimon, they're put on death row. They're waiting for that day to come. Torturous process, just waiting for that day to come. And finally comes the night before they are to be given the death penalty. Reuven and Shimon are both sitting in their cells. Of course, as you can imagine, their last night on earth, of course they're davening, they're crying their eyes out. And the next morning, the undertaker or whatever, the guy who's going to kill them, comes in, lets Reuven go, and Shimon was killed. And so they do a little investigation. What all of a sudden happened that Reuven is spared and Shimon is put to death? They committed the same crime, they had the same trial, everything was exactly equal. And so they did a little investigation and the rabbis of the community uncover that Reuven and Shimon both davened the night before in their cells, their last night on earth, but Reuven davened a tefillah shlema and Shimon did not. What's a tefillah shlema? So no, it doesn't mean that Shimon skipped karbanos and Reuven said karbanos. Doesn't mean that one shmoneser is better than the other. Rashi has one word. It's a one-word Rashi on the word shlema. It says niskaven. Reuven, his davening had kavana, and Shimon's did not. Now, I obviously can't argue with Rashi, but I have a very simple question. Does this story make any sense? Our backs are against the wall, Reuven and Shimon, it's their last night on earth, and you're going to tell me that Shimon didn't daven with kavana? I understand, you have a Sunday afternoon, football's on, you don't daven the best mincha ever, your mind's not into it, but the last night on earth, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, will be there soon. And maybe we can't even get muster up to have Kavanah the entire Rosh Hashanah, the entire Yom Kippur. But everyone's been there in Ne'ilah. Our backs are against the wall, time's running out. We have Kavanah, we find the energy to have that Kavanah. So what are you telling me that Shimon has no Kavanah, his last night on earth? Very strange. So I saw the following answer from the Sefer Lev Eliyahu of Rav Elia Lopian. And he says that there are two types of Kavanah one can have when faced in a dire situation. One Kavanah is a Kavanah of Yesh. You're davening, you have concentration, you have Kavanah, but it's out of Yesh, you've given up. Whatever situation you find yourself in, you feel that all hope is lost. And you sort of feel, you know, if this is going to be my last davening, I've got to make it count, but, you know, that's it. There's no hope left. But then there's another type of Kavanah. And that's one of hope and of confidence, of optimism. A person who believes that up until the very last second, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can save him. And that's the difference between Reuben and Shimon. They both have Kavanah. But one gave up. One had Yesh, and the other believed that until that last second, he can be saved. I'll give you a couple of examples from the Torah. We all know the famous story of Hagar and Yishmael. Certainly a story appropriate for Rosh Hashanah. Yishmael is dying. His mother, Hagar, sort of off to the side. She's crying. Doesn't want to see the death of her son. Kadosh Baruch Hu sees Yishmael there, he's davening, he's doing tshuva. The Malachim say, you know, listen, you know what this guy's all about. Is it really worth saving him? No. Barsher Husham. But it's interesting, and Chazal point this out in a few places. I mean, usually when we talk about rachamim and of tefillah, you would automatically think of the mother praying for her child. You would think of Hagar davening for Yishmael. But it's not what happens. Hashem hears Yishmael's tefillah. Because Hagar had Yesh. Hagar had given it up. To her, her son was as good as dead. It was Yishmael whose tefillah was a tefillah that he believed that he could still be saved. I'll give you another example. You know the famous debate of Noah. Noah, was he an East Tzaddik just in his generation? Or would he have been even on a greater level had he had the opportunity to live with the likes of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? So well-known machlokas. But we usually, if we say that he was only a tzaddik for his generation, but not if he was in the same door as Avraham, we usually assume, why? Because, well, Avraham Avinu, he davened for the people of Sodom, right? He was trying to be makari of others, not just worry about himself. Noach, he just sort of cared about himself, and that's what separates the two. Says the Kedusha Slavi. That's not what it is. If you look at Rashi, Rashi tells us that Noah was a maimon, but ain't no maimon. He believed, but he didn't believe. He had his doubts. He didn't have self-confidence. Right, we say that it took him to the water to get up to his neck for him to finally retreat to the teva. It's not that he didn't care about others. He just didn't think that he himself deserved to be saved in the first place. It was out of that feeling of yeyush and of giving up that he didn't try to save other people. He didn't even think that he would necessarily try to save himself. Avraham Avinu, on the other hand, what kind of person does it take to, for lack of a better word, have the chutzpah to daven with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? To argue with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem tells Avraham Avinu his plans, and we know Avraham doesn't like it. He tries to bargain. It's because Avraham had that sense of self-confidence. He had the type of tefillah, the type of kavanah, where he believed that his tefillah can make an impact. As I said already, we don't know. We don't know the impact that our tefillos have, whether it's like the mashal with us at the doctor's office, where we think we know what's best for us, but we're just that guy who's asking your doctor to prescribe you X. Or it could be a time like Nebuch in the summer where we think we really know. But what we do control is what type of kavana are we going to come forward with. Rav Kook, I've seen it written in Oros Teshuva, he says people struggle getting into their davening. It's not because they don't believe in davening. It's not because they don't believe in Hashem. They just don't believe in themselves. They don't believe that their tefillah can have an impact. Who am I? And who am I? What will my tefillah do? That's our biggest enemy. Ourselves. Share with you one of my favorite stories. Story of Rav Chatzko Levenstein, the Mashkiach of the Mir. As we all know, Mir, which was originally in Poland, had the schus to go there a few years ago. Not much there, unfortunately. I believe the Mir is a post office now. But we know that during the war, they managed to escape. They went to Shanghai. And you could imagine, probably can't imagine, what that first Yom Kippur was like. Young boys, teenagers really, managed to escape. Their families were left behind, probably to perish. You can only imagine what kind of Yom Kippur that was. But there was an accepted minhag in the Mir Yeshiva. The minhag was that, you know, unlike most places that we see where the Rav of the Shul, you know, whenever he finishes Shmona Esrei, that's when we'll continue. The minhag in the Mir was not to wait for Rav Chatzko. For one reason. He was known to daven for a very, very, very long time, and he insisted that they not wait for him. They have it down on record that his davening on the Yom Nuraim, when he finished Shacharis, the Tzibur was already finishing Musaf. It's about 1 to 2 hours at least, the longer tefillah. And so came Motzei Yom Kippur, and the Talmidim of the Yeshiva were finishing up the Shemona Esrei of Maariv after Ne'ilah. Remember that this was not just an ordinary circumstance. There was a lot of heat and disease and dehydration at that time in Shanghai. But the Bachrim decided, you know, for one time, let's make an exception. For one time, we're going to wait for a Rebbe, for a Chatzko. We're going to wait until he finishes Shemona Esrei before we go and break our fast. I mean, it's the least we can do. Imamish saved our lives. He took us here. He's like a father to us. Let's sit. We'll learn. We'll have a Seder. And when he finishes Shemona Esrei, we'll go. And so they sit down and they start learning. 20 minutes pass by. 30 minutes pass by. Just about an hour later, they're still going strong. Just totally on adrenaline. Rav Chatzko takes his 3 steps back, thinking the room is totally empty, turns around and is shocked to see this room full of Bachrim. And he starts to cry. He looks at them and he says, I want to tell you the following mashal. He says, imagine there's a man in the town, Baruch Hashem, who has a lot of parnasa. He's always looking to share with others. He decides to build for himself a magnificent house. The house will be used for mitzvahs of all kinds, for chesed. It will be used for a wedding hall, if anyone needs a place to eat, a place to sleep. That was his mission. And because it was such a community-oriented mission that he had, what better way to celebrate the completion of this magnificent house than to invite the entire community for Chanukah Sabayis? So he invites everyone, and he has in his hand just the final brick that he wants to lay on the roof. And he's climbing up the ladder. Everyone's watching, waiting for him to finish. They'll have a big simcha, a big celebration. And as he's about to place that final brick, a wind comes, and he falls off the ladder. Thank God he's okay. Just knocked unconscious. And when he comes to, a little bit disoriented, he looks up and he says, oh my gosh, my house is falling. And so they calm him down. They see that he's still a little bit confused, a little bit disoriented. And they explain, Rabbi Yid, your house is not falling, you fell. Rav Chatzko looked at the boys and he said, you've been davening Certainly, you've been davening for your families. You've been learning for the schus of your families. And sometimes you will feel that it's for nothing. Sometimes you will feel that you're davening, that you're learning, and your tefillos are not being answered. But remember one thing. What you have done through that learning and through that davening is you've built for yourself a mansion in Shemayim. You sometimes may fall, but that structure that you have built will always be standing. A person can look and reflect on what transpired this past summer and lose faith, have his emunah become a little bit shaky, or he can look at this past summer and understand, to take the words of Mrs. Frankel one step further. Maybe we'd like to believe that our 18 days of tefillah went to discovering the tunnel. Okay, that'd be nice. But if it didn't, we can imagine what kind of mansion did those tefillos build. But why? How did it get there? Why did we feel so sure that the boys would come home? Because that was a kavana that was not a vayish. Those tefillos were filled with kavana of optimism, of hope. Those are the type of tefillos that whether or not we see the answer in our lifetimes are tefillos that just build and build. And when a Kadosh Baruch Hu finds that this is the right moment, we'll do tremendous things. As we approach the Yom Nirayim, certainly, I'm sure all of us will be reflecting back on what's been occurring to Klal Yisrael, to Am Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael, to hopefully take this message with us, to remember that there is something that we can do, to remember that just because we don't know the outcome of the Master of the Universe's plans, doesn't mean that we can't have an impact. We have to believe in ourselves. Share with you one final mashal. We all know the well-known account, we'll be reading it on Yom Kippur, of the Asar Arugei Malchus. The 10 martyrs, 10 gedolim who were tragically killed. And in that account, we know that the angels, upon the death of Rabbi Kiva, come to HaKadosh Baruch and say what? They say, Zutura v'zeh Shurasan. This is the reward that one gets for toiling in Torah, starting at 40 years old. It doesn't seem right. Kadosh Baruch Hu's answer seems strange. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, silence. Be quiet. You question me again, we'll go back to Tohu Vavohu. We'll have to go back to the beginning. I'll restart the world. What kind of answer is that? Well, the answer I've heard given, can't remember right now exactly from where. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not ignoring the angels. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not disregarding their claim. He's saying, it's very simple, but it's not. If you want to know the answer to your question, if you want to know the answer to Zo Torah V'Zes Chorasan, the only way for me to really explain to you why this is happening is to go back to Tohu Vavohu. The only way for me to show you why this has to happen in a series of events that is the entire history of the world is to go back to square one. Because you can't understand this episode in of itself by itself. It's a part of a larger tapestry. You can only see the beauty of it when you look at the bigger picture, not when you look at the individual stitch. Hashem should be mechazik us. We should hopefully have the siyata shmai to understand what we need to daven for. But we're human. We don't know. We'll think it's best for us, but maybe not. But most importantly, whether it might be the best thing for us or it's not the best thing for us, if we enter into the slichos tonight with this feeling of confidence in ourselves and a feeling of optimism, being ready to build our own tower in Shemayim, to have that type of kavana, that's something that nobody can question and no one can take away. We should be zocha to a year full of bracha and atzlacha. Thank you.